I'm Doris Edmond.
Hi, Doris.
Hi. I've met quite a few of you, and it's just real good to have you here. My little presentation today is called Child, Parent, Grandparent. It's very difficult to talk about anything like this without getting personal. So forgive me, I'm going to be personal. I'm also going to draw from some of the so-called authorities and give you some of their personal observations and experiences as grandparents. The one I'd like to recommend to everybody, if you are a grandparent, a parent too for that matter, is Dr. Dodson's How to Grandparent. The reason I recommend it especially is because it has a wonderful appendix which gives you the names of books that are suitable for children of different ages, toys that are suitable for various ages, and games and that sort of thing. They sort of clue you in to where your grandchildren are at certain ages. Another one here is Grandparents, the Vital Connection with Grandchildren by Kornhaber and Woodward. Another is The Art of Grandparentry. That's by Betty Ewing Land. And then here's one called Then God Created Grandparents and It Was Good by Charlie W. Shedd. Each one has a little bit of a specialty. Some will be their photographs of children and grandparents. This one has Kornhaber has pictures that grandchildren have drawn of their grandparents, which shows what they think of their grandparents with interpretations of the drawings. As I said before, it's difficult to talk about anything like this unless you indulge in some reminiscing and talking about one's own experiences firsthand. Rudy and I are very fortunate in the fact that we have still living all of our brothers and sisters who range from their 50s to their 80s. And we're talking about this fact. How long are we all going to be alive so that we can get together and so that our grandchildren can meet their great aunts and great uncles and their relatives in the clan? We had been faithful in getting together our own nuclear family, and which is an extended one, of course, from California to Maryland. But we always have managed to get together at Christmas times. Three times we've come up here, which is a wonderful place for a Christmas family reunion because you don't have to worry about cooking the food and or where everybody's going to sleep or what they're going to do, because the skiing is wonderful and they always look forward to bringing their skis along. And that's reminiscent of the Midwest. Thunder and lightning. So we decided a year in advance that it was time for our clan to get together, our clans, that is, Rudy's clan and my clan, to get together. And since most of our relatives were in the Midwest, we thought it would be nice to have both reunions back to back somewhere in Iowa, since we had family in Iowa. And so we planned a year ahead of time, and our busy relatives, the younger ones who are still employed and were that way they were able to make arrangements for their vacation time. If they couldn't, they came on weekends. They flew in from all over for those Klan reunions. Just because we had planned far enough ahead of time, and just because we had never had one before on either side of the family. So I thought it might be fun to talk a little about that, what we did and what it meant to us. My side of the family, the children, grandchildren and great-grandchildren of Mary and Luther Swanson, who lived in Orion, Illinois, it was in the country, but the town was only about 600 people. We weren't such a big family. There were only four of us, and there were six grandchildren, six great-grandchildren. Our problem was meeting someplace where one family wouldn't be totally inconvenienced because of the deluge of people. So we asked my sister in Webster City, Iowa, to make a reservation in a motel for us where we could sleep. And we were going to be there over a weekend. And they had parks where we fixed picnics, and we went out to eat some, and we cooperated on dinners at my sister's house. But the nice thing about having it there was they lived on a little acreage just outside of town. So they had things to do that everybody enjoyed doing together. Croquet probably is one of the best games that children and grandparents enjoy doing. And they had a basketball and a hoop, and they had horseshoes. And there were just plenty of things to do there. But we spent a great deal of time looking through family albums. And we were just surprised that my sister had so many pictures of ancestors that I didn't have. So she let me take them to have them reproduced. And so I reproduced enough for my children, too. So they're building their albums. And Then on Sunday, we were there over Sunday, so we all went to a Sunday service, which was a wonderful experience. We had a day in our birthplace, the hometown of Orion, which, like I say, was about 600 people, and we looked up any shirt-tail relatives that happened to still be living there. We visited the homes where we had lived, took pictures, of course, and everybody was very gracious in inviting us in the house, and the places had been very well kept up, which made us feel good about that we didn't have to look at a rundown place that had been very dear to our heart at one time. And then we went to the church, of course, and found a cousin there quilting along with the other ladies, and then went out to the cemetery and told the children about the different ancestors that were there. All of our relatives were buried in that same cemetery, and it really meant a lot to them. My grandparents, of course, came from Sweden, and Then we went to Rock Island, Illinois, where Rudy and I had both gone to. This was just our own little nuclear family that went with our grandchildren. Went to Rock Island, where we had gone to college together and had gotten married. We took them up to the chapel, and it made such an impression on one of our granddaughters that I think she's going to go to Augustana. Living in California and never having seen it, of course, she wouldn't be interested. But now she is interested. Then on the second reunion, Rudy's family, there was a big crowd because there were six children and they all had lots of kids. So we couldn't go to any particular home. Even a backyard wouldn't hold all. There was between 60 and 70 people there. So the people who lived there in that place rented a church camp, and it just happened to be on the river that Rudy's dad had taken him fishing, and right close to the old farm where they lived, and not too far from the New Sweden Church, which is now a shrine. And there's the cemetery where we have bought a plot. And there's the baptismal font that had been dedicated to his dad. And while we were at the camp, well, his sister-in-law had put a little squib in the paper saying this, that the descendants of Amos and Minnie Edmund would be having a reunion at this particular spot and would welcome any old friends who'd like to drop by. And sure enough, old friends dropped by, people they hadn't seen since they moved from there. And then they had an old aunt and uncle who were in their 90s who were able to spend an afternoon with us. And then as a surprise, one evening at dinner time, an old neighbor dropped in, and he said, "I'd like to talk to the descendants of Amos Edmund." So he proceeded to tell our children and our grandchildren what a wonderful neighbor Amos Edmund had been to his father. His father had thought so much of him. And, you know, it just brought him alive to our grandchildren, and added so much to the experience of helping them feel their roots. And that was one of the things, one of the purposes that was fulfilled through these reunions. And it also afforded an opportunity for everybody to get to know everybody, because we hadn't seen each other. Some people were absolute strangers. And I think it surprised our 15-year-old granddaughters. You always wonder how the teenagers are going to take to a family reunion. But when we left, they cried. They just felt so much that they said, just think, we're not going to see them for 3 years. We had decided to have another clan reunion in 3 years. There's a little a bit I'd like to read here from Dodson on what roots mean and how valuable they are in the memories of children. Children like to know where they come from. They ask their parents to tell them what it was like when they were children. They like to think of themselves as part of a family line that goes back in time and has solidarity and permanence. And then to hear the experiences that their parents and grandparents had. Really hard times, of course, and knowing that other people have experienced hard times and that life is both hardship and delight is very helpful to children as they learn to face themselves. And he suggests that we make tapes of our family histories for our children. And he said, now that audio tapes are getting less expensive and more popular, that eventually everyone should try to do an audio visual tape for posterity. He said it's, if you don't have an audio visual, just a plain ordinary tape, or write it in a book. My daughter gave me a blank book. You know, you've seen these books that don't have anything in them. And I said, well, what's this for? And she says, to write your life story. Well, I must admit, I haven't done it yet. But I'm thinking about it. And especially after we got those albums together, that was an experience. And I found myself telling my children about the impressions that I had of each one of my uncles and aunts and their children, who were my cousins, and how we got together. We lived, all lived near each other, and got together for Sunday dinners and that sort of thing, which they haven't experienced too much of since we, in our family, because we've been too scattered. It says here that there are advantages in recording and writing your story, because there are no interruptions or questions to make you lose your train of thought. You can tell the story how and when you want to. Some stories might be embarrassing if you told them face to face, and I think we shouldn't leave those out. Add a little spice to your family history. If you change your mind about including a story, you can remove it or you can redo it. And the stories can be enjoyed over and over by your grandchildren, and perhaps even by their children years from now. The stories can be enjoyed by your own grown children as well. Maybe you had difficulty communicating with them when they were kids. Hearing or reading about your life experiences can help them to understand you better. If they get a new view of you through your history, it can help enrich your relationship with them. We always have every Christmas that we do get together, we show a certain number of old slides. We call it the funnies, the family funnies. And these are pictures of our children when they were the ages of our grandchildren. And they really are funny to see your own parents that you think of only as grown-ups on a slide. And then it says, now what would you talk about if you made a tape? You talk about your own parents, your grandparents, sisters, brothers, and other relatives. Where you were born, games you played as a child, places you've lived, your school days, your work experience, exciting events you have witnessed, sports you participated in, your own children when they were young, your grandchildren when they were young, the most happy, frightening, sad, or funny things you can remember. I wonder how many here have done this. Anybody written there? Have you done that?
Oh, written it? No. Not.
Well, what have you done?
Oh, well, we have family reunions quite a lot, and we go through our scrap books and we make tapes and send them to each other.
Great.
And at our 25th wedding anniversary, we had a big, about 200 people members of the family there. And we took better portraits of everyone.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, men, yes.
My husband gives us or makes a tea every time a grandchild has a birthday.
Oh.
Like the last one he made was, he says, when I was five, just like you are.
Oh, and that's wonderful. Yeah. Oh, just think how much that's going to mean to them in years to come when Grandpa's gone. Many years ago, everybody grew up in the old-fashioned extended family that included not only parents and children, but grandparents as well. Most of the time, all three generations lived under the same roof. Now, my grandfather was the only grandparent who was living when I was born, and he lived with us until he died when I was 9. I feel very fortunate that I knew him. He always called, he was the only one who ever called me Dory, and he'd always roll that R. And it, just the way he said my name, I knew he loved me very much. And he always spoke Swedish to me, and I always spoke English to him, and we understood each other perfectly. And it's amazing how those Swedish words have come back to me. We were over in Sweden, and we visited the old church, and the sexton was there. And you know, I understood him. And I even spoke a few words to him. It all came out of my subconscious. And my children just stood there aghast. They'd never heard me speak Swedish before. And I was kind of aghast myself, but there it was. So it's amazing how you can call forth some of those subconscious things in your older years. Our extended family also included a couple of my mother's brothers. who would drop in unexpectedly. They were bachelor brothers until they got, well, I thought they were terribly old before they ever got married. But anyway, they were always welcome at our house, and they'd drop by when they figured that my dad needed some help in the farming. And there was always a place for them to sleep and plenty of food, and my mother was just ecstatic whenever they did drop by because they didn't ride. She didn't know where they were. They just, here they'd come. And then my father had a brother. He was a little different type. He was an artist and traveled all over the world and did quite some nice things in painting, in oil painting. And the thing I remember about him was his letting me sit on the piano bench while he played the piano. And I just adored him. Oh, I didn't know. You know, he was some sort of a god. And then he left me all of his piano music, and I've passed that on to my grandson, who is a much better pianist than I am right now. Sociologist Leontine Young recently interviewed groups of parents, grandparents, and young unmarried adults on the subject of the family. One of the surprising things she discovered was that when the young adults talked about families, they frequently talked about something they felt they had missed. For some, it was family rituals, like turkey at home on Thanksgiving. For others, it was relatives living close by and filling the house with noise and security. For still others, the continuity of neighborhood and house and family routines. For all, there was a wistful longing, a feeling of something important missed but still vaguely sensed and symbolized by family as an ideal and in short dream. I know our children all carry out all the traditions that we ever had for birthdays or for Christmas or what have you. That's awfully important, even if they don't like the stuff, you know. What is it I'm thinking of now that doesn't smell very good?
Lutefisk,
yes. But they choke it down and they think this is Christmas, you know. You have to take the bitter with the sweet. But that feeling of it's part of our family really is so important to them. And then she goes on to say, these are not young people in trouble, nor are they, as far as one can see, alienated from their own families. They were thoughtful, well-educated, alert to the surges and conflicts of the day. Yet they seem more aware than their parents or their grandparents that some deeply important quality had gone out of the family, and they felt a loneliness for it. One youngster said to her mother, I wish we had more relatives close by. It would be so nice to have a big family to walk down the street with and to do things with. And a naive 18-year-old commented wistfully, the Depression must have been wonderful. I've heard my parents talk about it, and everyone was together. The whole family was in one place. One grandmother in Dr. Young's study made this comment. I feel sorry for my grandchildren because they can never remember what it was like to grow up in a family in a small town, as I did. They've lost so much. But not everything about the extended family was psychologically beneficial. There were disadvantages as well, and these ultimately brought the downfall of the extended family. Dr. Young tells of one couple's marriage which is foundering on the rocks of the grandmother's constant interference. Here is what one woman says. My grandmother grew up in Europe, and now that she's alone, she lives with us. She thinks we should have behave just as she did when she was young. She's always interfering, always telling us what to do. My mother tries to stop her, to explain that things are different now, but that only causes arguments. My brother won't even speak to my grandmother half of the time, and then she cries and feels hurt. I feel sorry for my mother. She's always in the middle. And then another young mother says angrily, I wish my mother-in-law would stop telling me what to do about my children. I want to do things my way, not hers. I wish I lived a long way from her, and then I'd be free. I wonder how many feel that way about it. It is precisely this sort of psychological sand in the gears that brought about the downfall of the extended family. There were also other factors, such as the shift from a rural to an urban society, the increasing number of women in the workforce, and the much greater mobility of families that began to exert a pressure on the extended family, which it was not able to withstand. But I believe that the major reason the extended family broke down was that in some ways it just didn't work very well in spite of its benefits. Everybody is familiar with the phrase generation gap, referring to the difficulties in communication between parents and their teenagers. But few people speak of the other very important generation gap that exists, the one between grandparents and parents. Where there should be an easy and fruitful contribution of grandparents to the raising of grandchildren, all too often we find only alienation and suspicion. Grandparents may feel that parents shut them out from a healthy enjoyment of their grandchildren. Parents may believe that grandparents are interfering with the raising of their children. Both sides need help in bridging the gap. I think both parents and grandparents need information in two basic areas. Child psychology, because every parent and grandparent is a child psychologist, whether they are aware of it or not. And one way to handle this is for parents to share their child psychology books and guides with the grandparents. They need information about teaching methods, because parents and grandparents are the most important teachers of their children. Then, of course, we have the problem of divorce, where maybe a daughter is left grieving through a divorce, trying to hold her children, support her children, and it's awfully easy then for grandparents to interfere, either making them feel guilty or just alienating them because they blame one side or the other. And of course, it's the children who really suffer the brunt of this. We grandparents have a great deal to gain by becoming a successful part of the new extended family. First, we will be able to establish a closer, warmer relationship with our adult children and our grandchildren. Then, too, we find that grandchildren can quite literally make one feel younger again. Being in close touch with our grandchildren as they grow up can be like drinking at some psychological fountain of youth. And that is certainly preferable to shuffling along glumly on the sidelines of life as we grow older. Another gain is that we can have the satisfaction of teaching our grandchildren things that will stay with them the rest of their lives. Each summer, our grandsons, they're 9 and 13 now, but our older grandson has been coming out here with us for a couple of weeks at Holden every summer since he was 7 years old. He fly out here from Baltimore by himself, and now his when we were back there one when he the spring before his little brother was going to be 7, he said to Rudy, "You know, Grandpa, next summer, Eric's going to be 7, and that's when I first got to come to Holden." So my husband says, "Well, next summer, if Eric wants to, he can come with you." So Eric's been coming with them every summer now. And some fishing, and he brags about what wonderful hikers they are and what wonderful fishermen they are. They're how patient they are. You can just hear the grandpa talking about these kids. But anyway, this summer, the older one is not going to be able to come because he has to go to a computer camp. And his young brother, he hasn't been doing too well in math, and this is a math and computer thing combined, and they figure if he goes to something like this, maybe he'll like math. He's a musician, and he's an artist, and he's a reader. But he needs to know how to figure his checkbook, you know, and make a budget balance. So his mother and father feel it's very important that he get on with this business of math before it's too late. But anyway, he agreed to go and said fine. He knew he needed it. But now the 9-year-old is going to fly out all by himself and back again. And I was wondering if he really would want to come without his big brother, but so far he's planning to come. You know, it's a lot easier to get to know your grandchildren when their parents aren't around. When you're the only parenting person. And even though you get along fine with their parents, and they get along fine with their parents, it's not easy to have more than one boss. You have to know who's in charge. And if you as grandparents are in charge, well, you have so much more flexibility. We have the boys here, and then when we go back, we have two granddaughters back there who are 15. They're twins. And last summer when we got back, we asked them if they would pick out a place they'd like to go. And we have a camp mobile, a little VW bus. And so they decided they'd like to go see the canyons, the Grand Canyon, Bryce Canyon, Zion Canyon. So that's what we did. And here again, it gave us time with just those two. The first time we did this, it was when they moved from Massachusetts to California. And we were out there for Christmas, and their father had to get to California. Their mother still had to finish a job in Massachusetts. So we took them with us on this camping trip back to California. And it was one of the most enjoyable experiences we've ever had. It was a good excuse for us to go to Disney World. You know, we had children to take. And we would probably never go by ourselves, but when you can become a child again and do these childish things and enjoy things through the eyes of your grandchildren, it is just literally drinking from the fountain of youth. And of course, they had to have their pictures taken in front of all the special places, like the sign that says this is the Suwannee River, and they had their pictures taken holding Indian River grapefruit, and we stopped along the way when they're and visited our friends too. So they got to meet some of our friends, and we had plenty of time. That's the nice thing about grandparents; they usually don't have to hurry quite so much as parents do. You know, ever since then, we have felt so close to those little girls. Now that they're teenagers, we get nice, warm letters from them. And whenever we call them on the phone, it's, "Oh, hi, Mormor." You know, we just feel like they know who we are, and they know how to talk to us, and we know how to talk to them. Now, they're living only 100 miles away, so we get together quite often for celebrations. We have always done a lot of celebrating. And it's so much fun to have the two families of our children, our children's families, to celebrate with. when they lived in Massachusetts, the little girls, I used to send them tapes. I'd read stories on tapes and send them these. I'd make up little songs and I'd converse with them, and then they'd send tapes back. And you just have to make a real effort to get close to grandchildren when you're 3,000 miles from each other. But it can be done. The weekend rates on the telephone are low, and that's when we always call and talk to them, or they call us. Whenever we visit our children, we still have a daughter and her husband, the two grandsons on the East Coast. But whenever we visit them, we always feel that they have prepared very carefully for our visit. And we feel that they're glad we came. I think this is awfully important on the part of the parents, to make grandparents feel welcome, no matter how busy they are. We limit our visits to a week or 10 days, and then we take little side trips because they both are doctors and they have very busy schedules. So we try to entertain ourselves during the day and not stay too long. Many grown children have the big problem with their parents that they feel that their parents are overly critical of them. And it's true that some parents just never stop finding fault. Janet, who is 43 years old, has two children, a daughter, 18, and a son, 14. She says, "My mother comes to see us twice a year and stays for 3 weeks, and the whole time she's there, it's nothing but nag, nag, nag. She seems to take great delight in telling me everything I do wrong, from the way I look to the way I cook. But most of all, she seems to find fault with the way I bring up my children. If you want to know the truth, I think I'm a much better mother than she is." Eleanor, and she probably is. I've always said that about my daughters. I say I feel that they both are better mothers than I ever was. Eleanor, age 29, is the mother of a six-month-old daughter. And she says, "My mother-in-law seems to start every sentence with, 'I don't mean to interfere, dear, but,' and then she starts interfering." Do these statements sound familiar? If your parent criticism bothers you, it's because you are still, in effect, wishing for their approval. And if it weren't your parent, and if you knew that what you were doing was okay, you wouldn't care whether they approved or not. So if you feel that you're doing a good job, try to let the criticism fall on deaf ears. Remember that everyone is entitled to their share of mistakes. Your parents must have made plenty of them in their life. You're entitled to make some too. There isn't such a thing as a perfect parent, so don't feel that you must be one. Dr. Dodson, in his book, How to Grandparent, suggests his creative listening plan. And he says, when your mother criticizes you, listen attentively to what she says, then state in your own words what she has said, and sometimes when you repeat the criticism this way, your mother will say, "Now that isn't what I meant. You're twisting my words." Then ask her to say it again so you'll get it right, and repeat the process until you can pinpoint the problem as your mother sees it. Once you have defined the problem to your mutual satisfaction, ask your mother for a solution. This takes some mothers by surprise because they think their only duty is to point out faults and let you worry about correcting them. But thank her for her concern and promise to give careful attention to what she has said, but don't feel you have to make a commitment just because you've listened. It doesn't mean that you're going to put her suggestion into effect. And I very strongly believe, as this author does, that we've had our chance with our children. And if they like our parenting, chances are they'll be the same kind of parents that we were. and even with this, the children who are abused, we find that those children grow up to abuse their children. It's just a repeated process. Then he goes on to say, now you might also maximize your parents' good qualities as grandparents. Most parents are much different with their grandchildren than they were with their own children. They have more patience, they're not nearly as critical, and they are willing to share their time and abilities. Mothers who wouldn't let their own children in the kitchen may happily endure smudgy fingerprints as they teach their grandchildren how to make fudge. And fathers who wouldn't let anyone near their fishing gear will show grandchildren how to tie flies. And when adults act in harmony with their parents, grandparents, parents, and children have a much better chance of achieving the closeness that is the goal of the new extended family. This closeness is revealed in an essay by a small child on grandmothers, and you may have read this someplace, but I thought I'd include it here. A grandmother is a lady who has no children of her own, so she likes other people's boys and girls. And a grandfather is a man grandmother. He goes for walks with boys and girls, and they talk about fishing and tractors and like that. Grandmothers don't have to do anything except just be there. They're old, so they shouldn't play hard or run. It's enough if they drive us to the market where the pretend horse is and have a lot of dimes ready. Or if they take us for walks, they should slow down past things like pretty leaves and caterpillars. They should never say, hurry up. Usually they're fat. Not too fat to tie shoes. They wear glasses and funny underwear, and they can take their teeth and gums off. It's better if they don't typewrite or play cards except with us. They don't have to be smart. Only answer questions like why dogs hate cats and how come God isn't married. They don't talk baby talk like visitors do because it's hard to understand. And when they read to us, they don't skip or mind if it is the same story again and again. Everybody should have one, especially if they don't have television. last fall, I was called out to Maryland, to my daughter's house, because they had had two deaths in the family. Her husband's sister had died at their home with cancer. And shortly after, his father returned back to his home in Port Angeles after they had begged him to stay because they could tell he wasn't well. He died alone in his apartment. And so I offered to go out there and stay with them with the boys while they went to Port Angeles to settle the estate, arrange the funeral and all those things. And when my daughter got back and was taking me back to the airport, we had just moved to the La Serena retirement village, and where we have independent living, but they also have nursing care there. A lot of people think, oh, you're too young to go to a place like that. But you'd be surprised. There are a lot of people in their early 70s who are there, the same age as we are, and we thoroughly enjoy them. But at the same time, they have nursing facilities, so that if we ever get to the point where we need help, it's there. And as my daughter was taking me back to the airport, after going through this trauma with Jack's dad, she said, you know, the greatest gift you could give us was your moving to La Serena. She says, now we won't ever have to worry about you. And I think sometimes, you know, we hold off doing things like that because we want to be independent, but we are putting a burden on our children if we don't know who's going to care for us when we do become unable to do for ourselves. So often older folks wait until they have to go to a nursing home before they can take steps to move where care will be available when they need it. And a lot of times when they need it, they can't get in. We feel very independent where we're living. And we take one meal a day over at the dining room and have such good company. We're just a block and a half from the college, so it's very easy for Rudy just to walk over there. And we've been able to get rid of one car that way. I don't know how much time is coming. It's 4:45, and I do want to hear from you people. So I'm going to just close now with Sam Levinson. I guess you all remember Sam Levinson. It's his ethical will and testament to his grandchildren. I leave you my unpaid debts. They are my greatest assets. Everything I own, I owe. To America, I owe a debt of the opportunity for the opportunity to give me to be free and to be me. To my parents, I owe America. They gave it to me, and I leave it to you. Take good care of it. To the biblical tradition, I owe the belief that man does not live by bread alone, nor does he live alone at all. This is also the democratic tradition. Preserve it. I leave you not everything I never had, but everything I had in my lifetime. A good family, respect for learning, compassion for my fellow man, and some four-letter words for all occasions. Words like help, give, care, feel, and love. Love, my dear grandchildren, is easier to recommend than to define. I can tell you only that like those who come before you, you will surely know when love ain't. You will also know when mercy ain't and brotherhood ain't. The millennium will come when all the ain'ts shall have become is's, and all the is's shall be for all, even for those you don't like. Finally, I leave you the years I should like to have lived, so that I might possibly see whether your generations will bring more love and peace to the world than ours did. I not only hope you will, I pray that you will. Now, I'd like to hear from you, and I know you all have your own experiences and your own success stories. Some of you might have some sticky problems that you'd like to talk about. Yes.
My mother-in-law is 86 and has lived alone most of her life. She has a dog and yes, has been her solace. She's very close to my son, who's her only child, and our five grandchildren. She wants to be alone, of course. She never talks about a nursing home, and I'm wondering if I should even broach the subject to her.
Well, does she have friends who live in a retirement?
They're all
retirement?
Independent friends, all of them.
I certainly wouldn't force her into anything unless it worries you sick. But if she's near somebody who can stop in every day, that's one thing.
She has neighbors on either side that are excellent.
Well, that makes a lot of difference. Yes. That makes a lot of difference.
And she doesn't want to go there, of course, no matter what.
But it's so many of them have real odd ideas of what you say nursing home. I say a retirement home.
Okay.
Because if you go there ahead of time, you don't take advantage of any of the nursing facilities. But then when you do get to the point where you need nursing facilities, they're there.
Right.
I know we just press a button and somebody's over there immediately.
Right.
In fact, I pressed that button by mistake when we first moved in. I didn't know what it was. And I was feeling for the light. It was dark and I was hunting for the light switch and I pressed that thing. And boy, before I knew it, somebody was knocking at our door. You know, what did you want? Something, you know, having problems? And so there is a feeling of security. And security is another thing. If you live in a neighborhood that's safe, or so many old people live alone in really unsafe neighborhoods in this day and age.
But the kind of facility you talk about is so expensive that you'd have to be very well off before you could even begin to think of living there.
Well, you'd be surprised.
Well, my aunt looked into it, and she's had a very good legacy from her husband. And, you know, the idea of $800 a month for a rather small place.
Has she ever sat to figure out what it costs to keep a house and to
heat
it?
Well, she's always lived in apartments, but, you know, she would have liked the thought of being in a retirement center, which would give her the nursing care facility. But you have to think of the next 20 years living that way. You know,
well, that's true. I mean, you have to be realistic.
Yeah.
It's true.
And I'm thinking of Social Security people. People who've been widows for years and years, they don't have that kind of money, and they end up being on welfare. And then even that gets to be a problem.
Yeah.
They pay for certain types
the
of
church,
facilities.
The church facilities try very hard to accumulate enough funds for scholarships for people who can't afford a facility. I know I'm on the board for Lutheran Homes in Southern California, and we have facilities that are less expensive and that are subsidized. I think the church needs to really feel an obligation here. They are not supporting our homes like they should. I mean, our colleges get it, but somehow I feel that the nursing homes, the retirement homes, should also get a budget, have a budget from the synods.
But you hear where people who have no other alternative except to be in a retirement or nursing center that are minimal quality in the first place have to give up everything they have. And they're only allowed a certain amount of spending cash out of whatever's left from their Social Security.
See,
there's an awful large number of people that are more in that category than are in the middle class category where they've been able to save up in anticipation.
Well, you have to pick what's right for you. You know, the same place is not equally suitable for everybody. But I think a lot of bad things have been said about retirement homes that aren't true. I know a widow just moved in to our facility, and she said, you know, I thought I would never be able to afford this. But she said, my son-in-law went through what it was costing me where I live now, and she said, it isn't going to cost me any more to live here than it would be back there, with the enormous heat bill that she had, and trying to keep up a house and a yard. And a lot of people find that it's not as expensive as it is to keeping up a home. But it all depends. You've got to do your own figuring, yes.
There's a trend now for to keep people in their homes, too, when they're ill, like a home nursing situation. In fact, I found out that it's quite a competitive field now.
Is that right?
Yes, for the doctors to refer their patients to nurses and whoever, therapists, whoever it is, and keep these people in homes. That's to keep the hospital costs down for the patient, and then they don't need to go to nursing homes quite as quickly either.
Well, that's sensible.
It is sensible. And that might strengthen your home family situation.
Yes, that's right.
It may not, but I mean, at least they're keeping the family close.
Well, I've noticed a real improvement in the health of widows who have moved in where we are.
That's great.
In the length of time that they're there. They've, they found a new reason to live. And they have companionship and a very stimulating program. Anybody else have...
Our children aren't married yet, but I appreciate it increased my awareness that if you want grandchildren to communicate with you later on, you must be doing things with them when they're young. You just don't all of a sudden expect it. It's like bringing them to hold them or going to some of their activities or send them a tape. You have to communicate all of a sudden when you find yourself you're an older grandparent, they don't want to talk to you. It's probably because you haven't given anything prior to it in some cases.
That's right. Anyway, you'd be amazed at the number of grandparents who do bring their children here because they don't have to worry about them. They don't have to entertain them, you know. They eat with them and they sleep with them and do everything else with them, but they don't have to be with them constantly. That can be hard, especially in a little apartment or something where they don't have any place that they can be and play. But we have to be creative in developing situations where our children can get to know us. Yes.
I just happened to think, I was just back in Minneapolis visiting my mother, and she has a Swedish cousin who kept in touch with the relatives there, and I don't remember, he's actually the son of our first cousin, who is about 25, and he's staying with my mother now for about a year, and he has been so helpful and so creative, and I think that the Europeans have a better sense of reverence for the elderly. And he has been so wonderful to her. She's just thrilled to have him there. Well, now some of my older children and my sister's older children have seen this. And they think, well, you know, maybe that's sort of a neat idea. Maybe I can go and live with grandma for a while and have a job and
right.
you know, be
right.
there.
It can be beneficial. Help both
home. I think it's
both ways.
Yeah.
Right, right.
I also want to put a plug in for Leo Busted's people pet therapy, you know, that a lot of times an animal, if a person likes animals, is beneficial to keeping a person
right.
active and
no, I think that's
giving
been
them
proven.
Something to care
yes.
for. And
definitely.
Mm-hmm.
Animal therapy.
Mm-hmm. I would just like to share what my parents are doing right now.
Good.
It's their 50th wedding anniversary celebration, and they've encouraged all of us to come. We've come from Alaska and California and Colorado, and we're all here for the weekend.
Mm.
But it's so much fun to see the cousins get acquainted because they've never all been together except in a small house in the middle of winter. You know,
that's right. You need space.
So I'm just really happy for this.
Well, thank you for sharing it.
23 of us here.
Yeah.
Wonderful, wonderful. Yeah. Yes?
I was going to say one thing that, in at least in my experience, and I think I see it in other families too, is we're still so patriarchal that we tend to, you know, once we're married, we're part of our husband's family more than we're part of our own. And I felt that very strongly, and it's just like pulling teeth to try to make any roots with my parents.
Oh, is that right?
And I was able to live in the Twin Cities on sabbatical for a year and try to get people together a couple days after Christmas and, you know, wrote to them, gave them directions how to get to our place. And, well, that was the day of the football game. Mm-hmm. Or we had this neighborhood birthday party thing and it happens to fall that day. You know, just not wanting to connect. And
it's usually.
I was so disappointed. And I guess they didn't realize what it meant to me, but some of these were cousins I hadn't seen since I went away. And I think that's still a way that we're not liberated yet, that we associate so much with the daddy's family. That I didn't hear you talk about getting together with your mother's family.